The Helicaster Jane Show airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern. The podcast always available online at HelicasterJane.com.
Peter, listen to me. You're a good-looking guy. You're a sexy guy.
I am?
I think so. I've always thought so. I think you are. Woohoo!
I agree with you. Wow. He's just handsome beyond words.
He's a lying sack. Go ahead.
Why do you think we've gotten along all these years?
All right. But here's where I'm going with you.
It's a little Liverpudlian in you, Ron.
Ron, I'm going to say something to you. I don't know if I've ever heard anybody say this to you on air. I'm going to say it, though. You are one of the most beautiful specimens of male ever put on the face of the earth. I am sorry. It is true.
There you go, Pete.
Peter is one of the sexiest guys walking, and you are. Ronnie, you are just a gorgeous guy. So, Peter, what's it like being on stage with this gorgeous friggin' face? I mean, really.
Gorgeous, sexy, funny, and oh so talented, Peter Beckett and Ron Moss. Part of the iconic band Player, two of the musicians behind the Titanic hit song, Baby Come Back, and Moss, for 25 years, the face of Ridge Forrester on the CBS soap, The Bold and the Beautiful, joining me at my table to talk music, success, magic, and more today on the Helicaster Jane Show. Hi and welcome. Thank you so much for being here. I am your host, Helicaster Jane. But before we begin, today the Helicaster Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by visiting my website at HelicasterJane.com and clicking on the Audible.com icon for your free book. Hey, what's more fun than a free book? And remember, the Helicaster Jane Show is always available online at HelicasterJane.com and a host of venues, including Stitcher.com, Spreaker.com, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, Blog Talk Radio, and on the iHeart Radio Network. Triple threat singer, songwriter, and guitarist for the rock band Player, composer along with musician J.C. Crowley of the Titanic hit song Baby Come Back, and a host of other hits, Peter Beckett is a force to be reckoned with. Best known for being one of the creators of Player, he has also written for some of the best, including Olivia Newton-John, Kenny Rogers, The Temptations, Heart, Sergio Mendes, and Grace Slick, to name but a few. And for television and film as well. And by the way, for over 8 years, he toured with another seminal rock group, the Little River Band. And Ron Moss, with Player from the beginning as a musician, his face might be best known as that of Ridge Forrester, the character he played for 25 years on the mega soap, The Bold and the Beautiful. But Player, well, that's home for them both, and they are back together again, performing for one night only, live in Florida at the Pompano Beach Amphitheater along with Little River Band in Ambrosia, Friday, January 8th at 7 p.m. I knew that I would be chatting with Beckett, but a last-minute surprise also brought me Ron Moss. How lucky can a girl get? Let's talk.
Peter, I'm going to start with you, Peter, okay? And really, Ron, feel free to jump in. They come and they go in this business. You guys know that better than anybody. Longevity isn't always there, but a few people managed to stick around for a while, and both of you did. Certainly you did, Peter. Talk to me. You always said that you wanted to make music your life. Is it everything you imagined?
It's been a, you know, roller coaster for sure. I've had some really, really good highs, and I've actually had a lot of lows. You know, it's kind of what you take on. I think we're lucky to still be around, and you know, another generation is like enjoying this music. You know, we're on tour every year now, which is great. It's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. Starting with you, Peter, you grew up in the UK, suburb
yes.
of Liverpool. Tell me a little bit about your childhood.
Well, I was born a poor black child in the, no, I was born in a, a rough area of Liverpool, Egbert, close to Dingle, very close to where Ringo was born, you know, and brought up. And, you know, it was a very rough place. It's on the cross of England, Ireland, and Wales. A lot of sailors, you know, in the old days. My mum was a nurse in the hospital down on the Dock Road, and, you know, there were, like, stabbings every day. She was dealing with some terrible stuff. It was a rough place. I can remember playing in pubs when I was about 16, 17, you know, with this other guy, and bottles are, like, flying past our heads and everything, you know, lucky to get out of there alive. But, you know, that's a long time ago, and I've been back a lot since then, and now it's actually very nice. They've really fixed it up, and, you know, it's like a different place now.
Let me get to Ron. What about you, Ron Moss?
I grew up in a very rough section of Hollywood. There were stabbings and murders all the time in my area.
All right, you.
I would come out often from high school, and my tires would be slashed every day. It was really kind of a hard thing to get through.
I get that. But so then for both of you, and one answer first, obviously, it then becomes hearing the music. The music gets into the blood. And I always say this about musicians, because I've never met one who isn't true about. They don't have blood coursing through their veins. They've got, you know, like rests and, you know, chords. And what's the deal? Where did all that come from in that rhythm of that early life of yours? First start with Peter.
Well, for me, I always wanted a guitar, and I couldn't afford one. And eventually, my dad bought me this. There was a pawn shop around the corner, and he bought me this banjo with a hole in the skin and two strings on it. And to me, it might as well have been a Gretsch White Falcon, because I loved it, you know, and actually learned to play a few things. And then I got, like, a Spanish guitar, and that's when I started, you know, really, really liking playing the guitar. And quite frankly, I really haven't gotten much better since those days, but I can pick out a tune, you know.
Oh, God, we feel sorry for you.
Well, after that, you know, my brother's older than me, and he used to go to the Cavern when the Beatles, before the Beatles made it, they used to play at the Cavern. They used to play lunchtime sessions for the office workers in Liverpool. And he knew one of the bouncers there, and I was too young to go in. And he slipped me down there, the bouncer, and him and the Beatles were playing a couple of times, actually. And it was so freaking loud, I can't even tell you, because it was a brick cellar. And the Beatles were loud anyway, you know. Probably by today's standards, it wouldn't even be that much, but really loud, and it really impressed me, you know. It was really exciting. And I think that was when I decided that I wanted to be in a band and started actually, you know, learning to play the guitar a little more. And I was in a band when I was like, I was in a professional band when I was like 17.
I know, that's
16,
amazing
17.
To me. What about you, Ron? What was
the same with the Beatles being the catalyst that ultimately put me over the edge. I've been raised around a lot of different music, mostly classical and jazz. But by the time I sat there and watched the Beatles on Ed Sullivan as an 11-year-old kid, I was just hooked, and I got it. And I said, that's what I want to do. And I started actually wanting to be Ringo. I built a set of drums out of cardboard boxes with little tins from candy dishes to be the cymbals. And we would go and play with various kids around the neighborhood just like that, with basically nothing, maybe a clarinet and a piano and my box drums.
Clever you
and,
were.
And I just, I got a very cheap drum set that my parents were kind enough to pay $200 for back then, the cheapest that they could find, and I had a little trio to begin with, and I went to rock and roll.
Wow, fascinating.
My sister brought home a bass, and I took that out of her hand, and off I went for the bass.
Were you born R-O-N-N, Ron, or did you make yourself Ron, R-O-N-N?
Well, it was always Ronnie.
Ronnie,
even
yeah.
Most of my closest friends, like Peter, still call me Ronnie, so I dropped the I-E.
Aha, I get it back.
The only reason I did that, I think, was because in SAG, you can't have two actors with the same name.
Oh, okay. I get that.
So there may have been a R-O-N Moss or a Ronald Moss in SAG, but I chose the Ron. Anyway, that's the story
behind the Ron Moss. So listen to me, both of you. How did you get together? I know that, first you came, Peter, came to L.A. You were at this party. So maybe we should start with that. Maybe we should start with how Player actually pulled itself together, and then how Ron got into Player. So let's start there.
I was mooching around L.A. with different kind of musicians, you know, just like getting together and playing and writing stuff. And I went to this party up in Hollywood Hills. Everybody was supposed to wear white clothes, and most people did. And I was in, just T-shirt and jeans, and so was this other guy, and we were the only people. And so we started yapping to each other, and he was this kind of oddball guy from Texas who was basically a country writer, you know. And he was kind of an interesting guy to me, you know, and he played me some of his songs over the next few days. And the lyrics were real odd to me. You know, they weren't kind of pop lyrics. They were a little to the left. And I was kind of interested in him, you know. So we kind of started writing some stuff. And then, Ronnie, was it Mark Roswell who knew you? You should probably pick it up.
It was Paul Palmer initially, who Peter and JC had gotten together and started writing some things together and realizing they were compatible. And our then-to-be manager, Paul Palmer, was with me at a session I was doing, and he said, I have these two guys I'd like you to meet. I think you guys would get along great. So we went straight away over and met Peter and JC, and we did get along, and we started up right there. And I brought my friend John Friesen, who I'd played with since we were 13 years old. He was the drummer.
He was the drummer. That's so funny,
he
right?
He was the drummer. Yeah. And so when the four of us did get together, it happened fairly quickly. We played and it got along real well. And that's when we all sort of decided, let's come up with the name and form this group called Player.
So you guys can tell me the truth, okay? Because nobody's going to hear this. Was it love at first sight between the two of you? Come on, you've been together forever.
Between me and Peter?
I'm kidding.
No, it was definitely
but I'm not
an
kidding.
Acquired taste.
It was what Peter was an acquired. Was Ron an acquired taste?
Taste being the key word.
You guys are cute. But I mean, this is, you know, before we go forward with the story, there is something about this, because with everybody coming and going and each of you doing your own thing, you guys have lasted together. What? How many years is this now? I mean, you're still great friends and play together after all these years. What's the secret here?
Tolerance.
What's the secret, Rod?
Tolerance.
Is that the
a
secret to a good marriage, too?
And a massive amount of wine.
It is kind of sweet, though, because, you know, really, the many came and went in Player. You know, you guys' careers took different paths, you know, The Bold and the Beautiful to, you know, LRB, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
But you did. You guys have weathered so many storms when so many in this business don't weather the storms. Fascinating.
Most of those tangents that we took were because of other reasons. They had nothing to do with us not getting it along.
No,
Peter
I know
and
that.
I have always gotten along. We got along famously. It took, when I started this TV show, that kind of took a chunk of time out. When Peter went to LRB, that took a chunk out for him. We both just sort of did tangents and came back to the road we were originally on. So it's worked like that. It worked very well.
So let's diverge for a second, because I want to go with, first of all, success. Success fascinates me. It must fascinate you guys, too. And you've been wildly successful, both of you. It appears anything you touch turns to gold, both of you. And I want to know why. I want to know why talent can't be bottled. That's for sure, but there is a lot of it out there. But success and making it to the top of the business, that's something else again. Peter, why do you think you made it first, and then we'll get to Ron?
I think it's perseverance, actually, because music can really beat you down. You know, I'll tell you honestly, there are thousands and thousands of people who sing better than me, write better than me, play guitar better than me. And I know this because I've hired many of them for sessions and stuff who never see the light of day. You know, they just do sessions and disappear. I've said this before, getting a number one record is lightning in a bottle. It really is. Getting any kind of hit record is lightning in a bottle, but a number one that turns into a classic. I mean, we had a bunch of hits. Our second song was number 10, but, you know, people barely remember it compared to Baby Come Back. Getting a hit of that magnitude is genuinely lightning in a bottle, and it was real lucky for us because it's still getting played today a lot.
A lot, a lot, a lot. Before we explore more of that, because I do want to get into that song, Ron, talk to me. What do you think is the reason for the amazing success?
I highly believe that success is truly in the eye of the beholder. Peter and I, what we've done together and separately, is our own level of success in so many different ways. I always try to see the success in one minute step, because if you can make one step forward, you're making a successful move. Sometimes success is measured in time. So there's really no pat definition of this. It's just you have to, especially as Peter said, in this business, this music business, the business does beat you down. And we can continue as musicians our whole life, but it's the having the positive feedback that is the hard part that's elusive. If we have one small step in the right direction, let's make that a successful, positive thing and parlay it into the next one. That's the way I look at it.
Fascinating explanations from both of you. Today's a sad day in the music business. Somebody who helped you guys out a lot passed away.
Robert Stigler.
Unbelievable.
Yes.
Right? Talk to me. I guess both of you jump in and say what you need to say. That company made you guys.
I credit, if I may say, Robert with two things in my life. One, he saw the potential and saw the capability and the talent in this group called Player, where others fudged and didn't give us the time of day when we needed it. And Robert also, for me, put something in my head of wanting to do the acting, which led me on another path, which I've used as well. And so he gave me two very important sort of chances to do things that I've grabbed a hold and ran with it. He's been a big influence on us from the beginning. And there's some very funny stories. I'll let Peter speak on this, but there's very funny stories of when we first met Robert.
Well, we actually only met him that one time a couple of times during the weekend, but the whole band went to New York. What was that movie? King of the Gypsies, I think?
King of the Gypsies, the Dino De Laurentiis movie.
And we were invited to the premiere in New York, and they flew us out first class, and we were supposed to spend the whole weekend going to all these parties in New York and go to the premiere. And we were on, remember when the Jumbo Jets had the bubble on top and they had a bar, an open bar, and you could actually walk around the bar on the plane in the old days? It was really fantastic. And we walked up to that bar, and who was sitting there, Ron?
Well, we realized when we were sitting in our first class seats that Robert Stigwood and David Frost, our then premier intellectual talk show host, were sitting right behind us.
Hmm.
Now, he didn't know you were going to be on that plane.
I didn't see them till we went up to the bar because my memory's a little different. I remember walking up and they were there in the bar sitting down drinking scotch. And they invited us. Robert realized who we were. I mean, we were all headed to the same place. And David Frost had just come back from the South. So he'd just interviewed somebody. I can't remember who it was, some major figure. And we all sat down and everybody started having a drink. And it turned into like a 4-hour long session sitting talking to Robert Stigwood and David Frost. And I don't know if I should even get into it, but it got pretty out there, you know.
And, tell us,
and
how did it get out there?
And then there a couple of the parties that we went to in New York, and Robert invited us back to his ridiculous 4-story penthouse on Central Park. Remember that, Ron?
That's where we all sat and heard the just-pressed acetate of Saturday Night Fever for the first time.
How old are you guys at this point?
20s.
30-ish, young. 30-ish, late 20s, maybe 30.
Mere babes in the woods and all of this is happening. Oh, my God. Yeah. Oh, my God. You want to tell me about any of that out there, or is it too out there to go there?
Well, basically, Robert played bartender to us for a 5-hour trip to New York.
Oh, that must have been fun flight.
He, as everybody knows, was an infamous drinker.
Right.
We were just turning into that.
We were semi-infamous drinkers.
That's right.
So wait a minute.
So we had a great time.
So you had a great time.
Good fun time. It was just basically the six of us up there in that little
bubble.
God, yeah. God, memories, right? You guys gonna ever write a book about all this?
Oh, I'm almost finished, man. I think Ron's just starting his, but
I'm just starting mine.
I got 220 pages, but it's taken me 15 years.
Well, you have a lot to sift through, I'm sure. Before we go further, Ron, I'm going to talk to you about the bold and the beautiful, but I'm going to talk to you about something different. I'm going to talk to you about the beautiful. Peter, listen to me. You're a good-looking guy. You're a sexy guy.
I am?
I think so. I've always thought so. I think you are. Woohoo!
I agree with you.
Wow.
He's just handsome beyond words.
He's a lying sack. Go ahead.
Why do you think we've gotten along all these years?
All right. But here's where I'm going with you.
I think it's a little Liverpudlian in you, Ron.
Ron, I'm going to say something to you. I don't know if I've ever heard anybody say this to you on air. I'm going to say it, though. You are one of the most beautiful specimens of male ever put on the face of the earth. I am sorry. It is true.
There you go, Pete.
I didn't say sexist.
About Ronnie now, right?
Maybe, but I didn't say Ronnie. I said Ronnie. No, I did say Ronnie.
Oh, I thought you were talking about
Peter. No. I said that Peter is one of the sexiest guys walking, and you are. Ronnie, you are just a gorgeous guy. So, Peter, what's it like being on stage with this gorgeous friggin' face? I mean, really? Come on.
Well, he's embarrassed me a lot in the past, I got to tell you.
He's going to kill me for going down this road.
The way he jumps around and does these ballet moves on stage and stuff. And it was even worse when he used to wear tights in the old days, you know. So, yeah, he's really something.
Allie, yeah. I used to wear stuff on stage just to see the looks on the guys' faces.
He used to wear stuff that we couldn't believe. He'd turn up to a gig and he'd have like a pair of pink tights tucked into red thigh-high boots with a big cavalier's hat on and spiked collar, you know, and gloves. We'd all just look at him and go, oh, my God.
I mean, oh, my God.
They actually got used to it. After a while, yeah. I got no response at all.
So you had to change, right? Yeah, you had to change. But, you know, here's the deal. And I'm going to go down this on a serious note. You know, it's one thing to be good looking. It's another thing to be gorgeous. And I'm just wondering if that ever got in the way of people really understanding just what a talented musician and actor, by the way, you are.
I appreciate that, Hallie, very much. But I can't honestly and seriously answer that question because
why not?
Well, as I said before, beauty is also in the eye of the beholder.
Oh my God.
And I don't view myself that way. I'm not egotistical enough to go that route. I just am healthy. As long as I'm healthy, I'm very thankful to the gods that surround all of us. And that's all there's really. If anything, how you look does affect the industry that both industries were in, music and acting. I take it for what it is. I don't make too much of it. And I just keep kind of grounded about all this because I have too many people who aren't grounded, who just obsess about the way they look. And I definitely do not. So
wow.
There we go.
Wow. Okay. I'll let you get away with that answer.
But I appreciate the compliment anyway.
Well, it is true. It is true. I mean, if I had a pencil and paper in hand, I'd be drawing that face of yours. I want to go back to you, Peter. I want to talk about Baby Come Back. I want to talk about the anatomy of the song before we get into the larger aspects of that song. So I want you to give me first the scene about how that baby came back to me, came out. How was it birthed? Where were you?
I'm assuming you mean the song Baby Come Back.
I did just say that, didn't I? I corrected myself, I thought, but I'm like, uh-oh.
I never wrote Baby Come Back to me or Baby's Got Back.
I'm trying. You know, I'm really trying. I mean, oh, my God. So talk to me about that, though. I mean, paint the scene for me here. A little chapter out of your book.
It's
the scene
kind of boring.
When...
You know, we can dress it up as much as we want to, but really, you know, I met Crowley, and I believe Crowley had just broken up with somebody recently, you know, and I had too. And actually, I was married when I came over here to LA in 74, and she went back to England. And we got together in my apartment in the Valentino. I was living in the Valentino building, which is just off of, where is that off of, Ronnie?
Highland Avenue.
Yeah, yeah. I know where you were. Yeah.
It was a really amazing old place, you know, and Crowley came over to my apartment, and we opened a bottle of wine, and we just started playing, and we started just playing these chords, which turned out to be the verse. And we got most of the verses like in the first day. And then we got together again the second day. And I had kind of come up with the idea for the chorus, actually. And we put it together. And that's when everything changed, as I'm sure Ronnie will agree, because we'd already gone around to different offices just with our little acoustic guitars, you know, playing songs live to them, trying to get a deal. And it wasn't until we put that song in. Everybody'd say, yeah, good songs, you know, whatever. And then we put that song in the mix, and we started to see the looks on people's faces. And the first ones to pick up on that were Dennis Lambert and Brian Potter at Haven Records. And they were the ones who took it to Al Corey, who was at RSO. He was like the main guy at RSO, who, you know, took it to Robert, and that's how that whole thing went down. But we definitely knew we had something just based on the reactions of people when they heard the song. I believe we actually did a showcase at SIR here in LA, and I think I was so cocky about it. Do you remember this, Ronnie?
I do
and,
perfectly.
We played four songs or something, and
just
I walked
before
up
we
to the
started,
mic and I said, I walked up to the mic and I know all these guys, all these record people, executives in the back, and we started, we're going to do Baby Come Back, and nobody had ever heard it. And I said, we're now going to do our first number one record for you. It's called Baby Come Back. And we did it, you know, and it was like really powerful. And I think everybody, and the next minute, you know, we had a record deal and we were recording.
And as I say, the rest is history. But I want to go back to one thing about this. And first of all, which came first? Did the lyrics or did the music come first?
All together. Sometimes it works all different ways. You know, sometimes you'll come up with a good idea for a lyric and you'll start to put music through. Sometimes you get some chords and you start to put words to it. And sometimes it all comes together, you know. I was a staff writer for a long time for many different publishing companies, and I got into that thing where I'd just wake up in the morning, you know, have a cup of coffee, turn on my machines, start the drum machine up, and create something from there. But they were never the best songs. The best songs to me come when I'm, like, doing the dishes or mowing the lawn or something, you know. Oh, my wife's calling me to do the dishes because I said that. Why?
Are you a poet first or a musician first?
I'm sorry?
Are you a poet first or a musician first?
Oh, I don't know.
Which comes first?
You know, it's
which comes more easy to you?
I'm sorry?
Which comes more easily to you?
It's both the same, pretty much. It's,
wow.
You know, some songs write themselves, and some songs it take me months to just, like, you know, I'll get three quarters of it and can't finish the last quarter. I've got something like that right now. I got a really good song, and it's kind of like my book. I can't find an end for my book either. So sometimes, you know, it all happens in a day, and sometimes it takes months to just find that right line, the right hook.
So you have this song, Magic, clearly. But, Ron, magic, I think, with a song that really does make it to the top is not just the song. There are a lot of good songs out there that they don't get to the top no matter what. So I think, because I was going back and listening, it's very funny because the day before Steve called me about this interview, I had heard it on the radio. And I'm singing away in the car going, oh, I love this song, blah, 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 blah. It was like, and then he called me the next day. So there's a certain serendipity, LA kind of serendipity to this thing.
Yeah.
But what I was thinking about the song was, while I was listening and singing it, was, it all came together, right musicians, right writing, right. You guys all together made magic on that song. How often does that happen in life? Ron?
Callie, what happens is every note was exactly right.
Exactly.
And that song, that particular song, had that elusive sort of
magic,
intangible magic. That a lot of songs don't. They're just songs that will last a few minutes or a couple years and they'll be gone. This song will never go away because it still resonates with everything that was involved. It had just the right colors, just the right flavor, just the right feeling, and it tapped into people's inner thing. So
it still taps into people's inner thing.
If that was a formula, everybody would be doing it. Everybody tries, but you cannot duplicate that intangible thing that happens. And that's what happened with this song and the four of us doing it.
Did you know it at the time? Did you know it?
Yes, we did. We actually knew it at the time. And after the fact, when Peter said he said that at that showcase, where we had many different record companies, several of those record companies came up to us after the fact and went, we knew that was going to be a number one hit.
Yeah.
Of course, we wanted to say, well, why didn't you put us an offer back then?
Yeah.
But basically Robert Stigwood got to them, got to us first.
Including, is this true? Clive Davis actually turned you guys down?
Yep.
He did. And I'm sure.
And he had Baby Come Back.
Huh?
Baby Come Back was in the mix when we played for him.
Where
was it, Ronnie? The Hilton Ballroom or the Beverly Hills Hotel?
The Crystal Ballroom of the Beverly Hills Hotel.
Yeah.
And he said, you guys look great. You sound fantastic, but I don't hear a hit. I think if he had been given a second chance, he would have rethunk that answer.
Did you ever get the chance to say to him, Mr. Davis, you screwed up?
Well, everybody
but he hasn't
has
been wrong very often. You know?
No, but he surely was with this, which is one of the iconic songs of all time. I mean, come on. He really screwed up on this one big time. I mean, right? Wouldn't you love to say that if you haven't?
I'm sure he's made up for it since.
Well, he may have, but nevertheless, I mean, he's the kind of guy, it strikes me as he wants them all. He probably beats himself up that he doesn't get them all. There's something else I want to bring into this, and that's spirituality in a way. Listen to where I'm going with this, because I think another aspect of all of this is to create a song like that, you have to really feel deeply on a whole lot of levels. That has to come through in the putting out, the putting together of, the putting out of the song to get it down, in a recording kind of thing. A sensitivity, if you will. So
it's called soul.
Okay, that's what you call it. Ron, what do you call it?
I call it just the inner God, and I don't speak in terms of Jesus God. I speak in terms of your inner God, your inner feeling, your emotions, everything that's real. The song speaks of a realness.
So,
and I think it resonates with other people. They feel it too.
How hard is it to tap into that? In performing that song, which you now must have performed 5,200 billion times.
It always feels good. That's a good point. You know, whenever we do that song, whatever circumstances, whether it's acoustic or you know, the full band or whatever, it always feels good. It's a good feeling song. You know, the lyrics are good. The chorus kicks in great, you know. And, of course, I play an amazing solo at the end. I'm just
thanks.
Kidding.
Thanks for
but
telling us.
Yeah, yep. You know, it's a soulful song from start to finish, from the bass riff at the beginning right to the solo at the end. It's got soul. And, you know, I'm not blowing smoke up everybody's you-know-what here, but I just I believe that the song has that thing. It's a soulful song. That's all there is to it.
Allie, I got to say, every time I've ever done that song, mm-hmm. I love it.
Really?
And I never bemoan it. I have never gone, oh, don't ask us to play that again. I've never done that because it has that magic spark to it. And it's great to see people's faces when they hear the first few notes and they go, well, I love that song. Or they go, that was you guys? One of those two reactions always happens.
I thought that was Hall of Notes.
Where are Hall of Notes these days, by the way?
Are you kidding? You have seen Daryl's TV show, of course.
I haven't. No, I'm too busy running, talking to people like you all day and all night.
No, he's got a show on Palladia called Daryl's Ranch or whatever it's called, Daryl's House. And he has all the new performers on. He's doing great.
John Oates
just actually had a new album out that I heard. I saw him doing it on TV live, and it was really good. So those guys are doing great.
I love those guys. And talking about that, I heard an interview, Peter, where you said something to the effect of you guys had a certain sound, and that was your sound. And then when they put you on tour and they're booking you with some pretty heavyweight, heavy-duty rock
Eric
stuff.
Clapton.
Right. It starts to change, and you got a little into more heavy kind of a sound. That, do you regret? And what about you, Ron? Do you regret? Start with you, Peter.
I don't know. I know that happened because I remember the change. I knew what they were doing. We were kind of a power pop slash R&B blue-eyed soul band. And people were putting us in a little more into the soft rock thing. And then we were told that our second tour was going to be after we did Buzz Skaggs' Silk Degrees, which was very much similar to what we were supposed to be. And then we were told we were doing the Slow Hand tour with Eric Clapton. And I think we talked about it, and we couldn't see doing all the songs that we did with Eric Clapton because he's Eric Clapton, and it's, you know, it's a lot heavier than us. And after Cream and everything. And so I started to, without a doubt, I know I changed my writing. I started going back to what I did in England and doing much, you know, things like Silver Lining and little harder edge rock songs so that when we did that tour, you know, we would sound like we belonged on it. And it actually went great.
What about you?
But, you know, I don't know if I've always had a weird feeling about that veering away from the R&B sound.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not sure whether we made the right move or not, but, you know, we did it, and there you go.
What do you think, Ron?
People always knew us because of the success of Baby Come Back And this time I meant it for love, right. And it's for you, which were all in the R&B sort of vein.
Mm-hmm.
And they boxed us into that sound when, in fact, on stage, we were very much a rock and roll band. Yeah. We had some great rockers in our first and second album that we would play when we'd play live. But most people heard on the radio just our blue-eyed soul R&B stuff.
Well, you know, that was a time when everybody was getting put into a box. You know, heavy metal, rock and roll, right. Blue-eyed soul, you know, R&B, whatever. People were getting put into boxes. And truthfully, if you think about the Beatles, and I'm from Liverpool, and everybody loves the Beatles didn't think about, you know, having a vein through their album. Well, oh, we're a heavy metal band. Everything has to be heavy metal. I mean, Helter Skelter, you know. And then, you know, Yesterday, they didn't think twice about mixing it up.
Yeah, it's an interesting
huge variable.
It's interesting to look back on that and to see, you know, the evolution of all of that.
Yes.
When you hit number one, few people get to do that. But when you hit number one, where were you? What was the feeling? And can anything in life match it? Talk to me, Peter.
Well, I'll tell you this. I was more excited when we were rehearsing in this down horrible little studio called Rats. We were rehearsing to go out and do some stuff with Gino Vannelli. And we just put the album out, and our manager came running in, and he said, "You're not going to believe this. You guys are number 80 on the top 100 on Billboard." And we just about, remember that? We all just about fell to the floor. We couldn't believe it. We actually had something on the charts. And from then on, it jumped every week. And as those weeks went by, you kind of got used to it, you know? Whereas the actual thing of getting on the charts, to me, was like the biggest thing. And, you know, by the time it hit number one, it had already been number five and number three, you know? So then it's like, well, I hope this makes number one. But I remember where I was. I was in my apartment, still in that Valentino building, and there was a well-known musician living next door to me who I won't name, but I had taken three of the songs, including Baby Come Back, and I'd played them to him, you know, sometime before this. And he said, yeah, it's okay. I don't hear a hit, you know, kind of like what Clive Davis said. And he never kind of looked me in the eyes again after it hit me.
And you're not going to tell us who that was? Why aren't you telling us who that is?
Just
give
no,
us,
I can't.
Give
I
us
can't,
initials. Give us initials.
It wouldn't be fair.
What about you, Ron?
I have a different excitement point for me. It was great to hear that we had hit number 80-something, just entered the charts. The second most exciting thing for me was I remember vividly me, J.C. Crowley, and Peter Beckett driving in my, I think it was my old 63 Mercedes. We were driving up La Brea or one of the streets in L.A., and we heard it on the radio for the first time. It actually came on. I remember that so well, and all of us just going, holy crap,
actually, yeah.
This is really happening.
Wow. Wow.
And it sounded so great.
And then it got to the point where you couldn't turn your station on your radio without it being on every station.
Exactly.
Kind of crazy.
How does that change you, Ron?
It changes you because it gives you the boost you need to go, this is really happening, and we've got a good chance of doing something really great here.
Going forward, yeah.
That's right.
Wow.
But truthfully, you know what I noticed, Ronnie, you might remember this. You know, you always hear about people changing, and I don't know how true this is. I'm just going to say this anyway. But what I noticed when we were like on TV every few minutes and the record was on the radio every few minutes and we had billboards of us up on Sunset Strip and everything, I noticed people that I knew would treat me different. I didn't feel like I changed at all, but people would like treat me different. They'd look at me different. They'd talk to me different. And, you know, that was a little weird to me because, you know, I didn't feel like I did. You feel like you changed, Ronnie? I didn't.
I don't feel like I really changed much. We were a very close knit group, the four of us, and we would go out often, even when we weren't playing.
Yeah, we used to go out to lunch.
We would go down the Sunset and just hang out and be a group together, which was really important then because we were all bonding and things were moving very quickly. I don't feel like I changed either, but I do agree with Peter that people around you change. You get a combination of both a friendly great, guys. You do, you know, everything's going great. And you can also sense that sort of hidden animosity underneath.
So you guys are great together. Unbelievable. And then you're not together. What happened?
Well, one thing that happened, we stopped touring. We stopped recording with Player because two of our record companies folded from underneath us. We'd gone from RSO
and
to Casablanca.
Casablanca. Yeah.
Yeah. And they just, for other reasons, the owner of Casablanca had died just before we got with them. So they were on the downslide anyway, but we weren't doing anything. And, I personally on my side decided to pursue the acting. So, and I wound up getting this TV show. Peter decided to start doing, music for movies, which he did. And he decided to join Little River Band. So it took us both on a tangent. It was just a way to make a living when Player wasn't actively doing their business.
Doing anything, yeah.
But your heart stayed with Player, both of you, right?
Pretty much.
I'm sorry? What did you say?
I said your heart stayed with Player, even in the years that Player wasn't playing together.
Ron went on and had great success in The Bold and the Beautiful, and I actually did another two Player albums after that. But, you know, I always wanted Ronnie in the band, but truthfully, he was real busy and doing great. But then we got together later. I don't know what the year was now. Maybe, what year was it? And I said, why don't we do a Ron Moss album? I'll write it and produce it. And we started doing that. And then, you know, halfway through it, we said, why don't we just turn this into a Player album and finish it up?
Yeah,
and that's what we did, and that was the start of the ball rolling again, you know.
I didn't have the time to do much music when I first started the show because it was just too all-consuming, and that's why Peter just kept going with the music. I never actually quit Player. I just had to stop and do something else that was taking all my time, and I think it was around the mid-90s when he and I finally got together. He played me a couple of great, amazing demos that he had sitting around for a while, and I went, those are great songs, I'd love to do those songs, and it's kind of started us going in that direction.
So,
well, truthfully, we couldn't also do a lot of gigs because we can only for many years when we started actually playing again, Ronnie and I with other guys, you know, we had some major players go through the band, but we could only go out on occasional weekends because he was doing his TV stuff, and I would get these, you know, I'd be doing songs for these movies, which would take a lot of time in those days. And so we actually just went out, and we were like a weekend warrior band for a while there, but now Ron's not on the show anymore. We're actually doing these tours again. We're doing full tours through the summer and everything. So we're back out there, which as we can be, you know.
Yeah, Ron,
yes.
The Bold and the Beautiful. That is such a strange thing to do, soap operas. I have a lot of friends who've done soaps. That's a hard word. That's hard
trust
work.
Trust me, I didn't intend for it to go 25 years.
Jesus,
I thought a couple of years and I'd be done with it.
I mean, unreal. And the time that it takes to put one of these things every day together. I mean, this is you have no life. You had no
a
life.
A phenomenal amount of time. It was life consuming, and I had to decide to dedicate myself to that. Otherwise, I knew I wouldn't be able to do it.
So you stayed with it 25 years. Regrets? Happy? Wish you hadn't? And maybe
no,
take
I am,
the music?
I am completely and totally in gratitude that that was there. Because as an actor, you can't get any more constant work. What I finally had to do was to break off and make sure that my time included enough time to get together with Peter to do the music stuff that we both were so passionate about. For him, it was his complete and total living. And for me, it was something that I wanted to make a living from, that I wanted to spend more time at. So I had to, I made time for it somehow. And we would take the weekends, like he said, and make time for it.
So 25 years later, you leave. Oh, my God.
Yeah, well,
I mean,
I figured
is that
25
like a nervous
years
breakdown?
Is a good,
yeah, but is that
a good
nervous,
amount of time to dedicate to anything?
But that's given up half your personality, I gather, because you were a ridge. I mean, no question about it. How hard was that to leave? How hard was that on you for a while?
It was both difficult and completely easy because being ridge was and is great. I will continue that with always. I never deny that. But I want to take the opportunity to do other creative things.
Speaking
I don't
of
want
other,
that. I yeah. don't want that to be my only legacy in the acting world. So I have several different things that I'm hoping will pan out and grow into much bigger things than B&B.
That's cool. And you bring this something up that I did want to ask both of you, and that's about this. You're triple threats. I mean, you're writers, you're musicians, you're actors, my God, you guys do it all, right? So I'm going to ask
Peter's
you.
An actor too, by the way.
Yeah, I know that.
I'm a better actor than Ron, actually, but you'll never admit it.
So here's my question, though. Seriously, if you had to give one up, live without one of them, if the gods said and say we're taken, which one would be the hardest to give up, Peter?
Oh, I'd give up acting today. I mean, it wouldn't bother me at all.
And
even though it's been a major part of my life, I could drop it in a heartbeat.
And Ron?
Let me answer that with an old joke.
Okay.
An actor goes
old,
in,
right?
For an audition.
Uh-huh.
And the producer says, I'm sorry to get this role. You're going to have to cut off one of your arms. So the actor comes back later and he cut off one of his arms. And the producer goes, oh, I'm so sorry. Wrong arm.
So I told you his jokes were all old. So there you go.
the point being, well, I wouldn't give up either one.
Oh, yeah, right. I hear you. And I want to go here with that. Okay. So this success thing, this is a weird thing, success. People don't understand because so few people even get there. But it is weird. And it's weird in this because once you get there, there may be a downside to it as well as an upside to it. And I wanted to talk to you guys about that a little bit. Happy, fulfilled, or does it bring an unexplained set of emotions that you weren't even prepared to understand? Is there a downside to it? Like, I've been so high, baby, there's only one way to go, and that's down. Talk to me.
I think that happens to some people. I think some people go, I think Ronnie will tell you that this is true about me. I've had some real dark spots, and when I'm challenged, I tend to just put my head down and charge forward. Right, Ron?
Absolutely. That's always been his MO. And
a lot of people don't. A lot of people, when they get, you know, start worrying about things, they have a bad time, you know, can fold. And I do attribute that to my upbringing from Liverpool. That's just the way it was when I was a kid, and I, you know, that's pretty much where I am now.
What about you?
For me, I don't take anything that we as player have achieved as the ultimate. I always look to the best that we're going to do is still yet to come. That just has to be my attitude of moving forward in life. I do that with the acting as well. Anything. We're both in very squirrely businesses, and it's easy to be beaten down in this business. We have many friends who have been beaten down. As Peter said, he always puts his head down and goes. I've always admired that. I've learned from that a lot from him. You have to keep going. You have to get up the next morning and make the choice. You have to start fresh. And I've tried to do that all my life. And it hasn't been easy for me either. I've had my severe downs. I don't always talk about it with anyone, but they've been there. But you have to make up your mind. You keep going.
You pick yourself up, you dust yourself off, and you start all over again.
You keep going because the best, I always view the best Peter and I will do is yet to come.
So you guys are committed. You're like in a little marriage together, huh?
I have been married to this guy figuratively more than any, we've been with each other more than any relationship with any women we've known. It's been amazing.
I kind of got that. I really, really did. I'm going to digress for a second because, Peter, you're such a character. You are a character.
Yes, he is.
Is it right? I mean, we all know that. But you said something recently, and I don't want to get into the whole political or legal spiel, but you just said something that I read that I just cracked up laughing. Because you know what's coming, right?
No, I don't.
You don't? I'm talking about your little comment about Keith Urban. I mean, I'm sorry, darling, but you are so friggin' funny. You are.
Man.
You got a sense of humor about you.
I didn't say that.
You're going to tell me you really
I did not say that.
Here's the quote.
I know exactly what you're going to say, and I never something about he's only famous because of his wife,
and
right?
And you never said it?
I never said it.
Oh. I wish you had.
And truthfully, it's actually, I wish I had said it, but I didn't, you know. That was like, It was nothing to do with me.
I just had to go there. I'm sorry, but that cracked me up. I mean, I was crying. I was laughing from that line.
Yeah, well, let's move on.
You know, you got
to
go.
You know, I actually think he's great. You know,
no.
But the,
yeah. Okay. All right. Well, I won't. See, I said I wouldn't do the other part of it. I just wanted to run that one by because that just cracked me up and totally. There is one other thing I wanted to talk to you briefly about.
I just wanted to say one thing. I know Keith personally, and he really is such a kidder, isn't he?
A kidder?
Yes.
A kidder.
That was better than his jokes, you know?
There you go.
That's very good, Ron. I like that.
Okay, there you go. The other thing that I wanted to go with you just for a minute, Peter, is on this, because you played with LRB for 8 years, and I had Wayne Nelson on the show not too long ago, and we got into kind of a really great conversation. You ought to listen to that interview. I think you'd appreciate it, about the fact that so many nasty people out there want to label LRB as we know LRB today as a cover band. And actually, both Ron and you can both talk to me about this, because I think art is evolutionary. I want to see art evolve. I want to see bands evolve. I think if they just stay stuck, then that's what they are, is stuck. You never know how far out they can take their talent. And so it's lovely to see how they morph, how they go forward, whatever. And I don't think it's any disgrace to the original. I think it only adds to the story. You know, there are a lot of people who say, if they're not the originals, they're not the band. Talk to me.
I'm kind of pulled on that whole thing. I got to be honest with you. I mean, first of all, Wayne's been in LRB for 37 years. He was in LRB when I first joined LRB.
Right.
And he was in it after I left. I want to pick them as an example, but you can say the originals did it all. They wrote the songs that were successful, and other people are kind of making money off of what they did. But the other half of it is, I know all those guys, and the other guys left the band.
Right, with their choice.
It's not like they were kicked out and replaced by new guys. They said, I'm not going to be in this band anymore, you know. And, you know, I don't really... You know, I'm pulled both ways on it.
Ron, you got anything to say on that subject?
I believe that music as the canvas that you see when you think of a band is the thing that endures. And very often those bands lose a member, a member dies or goes on to something else or whatever. But the music can always endure. And if there is a band that's playing that music, I think it gives the public a chance to experience something they may not have experienced if the original members of LRB decided not to perform anymore, which they did at a certain point.
And it was their choice.
Yeah. I think it's an interesting conversation.
Yeah. So other musicians decided to continue the legacy of that amazing music that they made with their own band. If you call them a cover band, yes, you may be right. But they're still perpetuating something that otherwise may be lost.
Fascinating subject. We could do a whole show just on that. Here's something about I love about music. And you brought it up, all right, just in one word you just used. Good music never dies. Durable. The world recently celebrated the 100th anniversary of Frank Sinatra. This fascinated me. It was so much fun to me to watch and listen to some of the greats of our era, right, sing Sinatra tunes on PBS. And wherever else they were doing that. And I know that in 40 years, people are going to be doing the same thing with you guys, right?
I don't know about with Frank Sinatra.
Well, no, wait. Just listen to where I'm going with this for a second before you answer me, okay? Because this is what I want to say. Because I want to ask you about the music industry today as we know it. I want you to tell me if you think that Kanye West songs are going to be hummed and sung to, and PBS is going to be doing, or whomever it is, are going to be covering that music like Baby Come Back. What's going on with the industry?
I think there's a lot of stuff that becomes big that you'll, you know, after a year or so, you'll never hear again. I also think that's partly because the pool is much bigger now. You know, when we were around, it was a much smaller pool. There was a lot less music, a lot less bands. I mean, there's just, it's so big now and music business has changed so much. But
what about you, Ron?
There are songs, you know, that will still be around. But
there's so much information out there.
Right.
So much disposable information. And I truly believe that a lot of those songs that are being released today are part of that disposable group of things that are just going to come and go. I know the kids' perception of them is they'll listen to a new song for 30 seconds and they'll go on to the next one.
It troubles me. It troubles me.
In my youth, and I dare say in Peter's youth, when we listened to a song, it stuck with us. And we listened to it 500,000 times. Kids today now, you're lucky to get 30 seconds out of them and they're on to the next new favorite song. So that kind of tells you the attitude of these kind of songs and the disposability of them. And I do not think that a lot of artists today will be recognized. I do believe Baby Come Back will stand the test of time. It has already proven that.
I think it definitely has. I did not forget to talk about the fact that you guys are on tour. You brought it up. We brought it up at the beginning of the show that you'll hear when we put it all together. You're going to be in Florida, Pompano Beach, at the amphitheater.
Yes, we're at the Amp. This coming Friday, we set out on Thursday, and we're performing at the Amp in Pompano Beach, 7:30, I believe. Right, Ron?
Yes, 7:30.
Yep.
Live.
And
one night
we're performing
only
with Ambrosia and Little River Band, and that's it. Three bands, Player, Ambrosia, Little River Band. And you're going to hear a lot of hits if you come on down.
I'm going to try and get down there. I really, really am. And I want to know, so what's going to happen with you guys? You recording? What are you doing?
Well, yeah, I kind of went through a dry spell, to be honest. We put a new album out a couple of years
ago. Yeah, that I know, yeah.
And it's called Too Many Reasons. It's a real good album. We didn't expect to get another number one, you know, but it was nice to be able to go out and tour having an album released. We were the only band on the tour that had an album out at the time, you know. I've got a bunch of stuff I've been working on. Ronnie told me he's writing some new stuff. We could probably have something going by the end of this year, you know.
I hope you do. I really, really hope you do. And I want to talk to you about, let's go back to where we started a little bit ago. And Peter, you're remarried. You have young children, yes? Relatively young?
I have a 14-year-old boy.
I know this because when we were talking pre-interview, he had to worry.
And a 15-year-old stepson.
He had to worry about picking kids up, and he's doing the carpooling thing, God bless him, at 66, almost 66 years young. Hey, buddy, you do look fabulous. You do. You sound as good, or if not better, I think, than you ever sounded. So what vitamins are you taking?
No. Bloody big ones.
Bloody big ones.
Bloody great big ones.
And for both of you, I ask this final question. I say to you, can you ever use up all the love in your heart?
No. I think love is self-perpetuating. The more you give, the more you get.
I think you can get a bit bruised, but like everything else, you pick yourself up and move forward in love as well as war.
I've been speaking with singer, songwriter, guitarist, co-founder of Player, and co-writer of one of the most iconic songs ever written, Baby Come Back, Peter Beckett, and with Ron Moss of Player, and for 25 years the star, as Rich Forrester, of The Bold and the Beautiful. They will be together again in South Florida, Friday night, January 8th, at the Pompano Beach Amphitheater, where Player will be performing with Little River Band and Ambrosia, 7 p.m. Eastern. For more on Player, Ron Moss, and Peter Beckett, and future tour dates, visit playertheband.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to the Hallie Cancer Jane Show, a production of Resac LLC. Associate producer, Suzanne Probst. Music by Tony Rosales Jazz. Visit HallieCancerJane.com.